KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
This is not Mean Girls. This is not some episode of some television show. This is very serious. People are going to... Today, people will die in this war.
Ukraine agrees to a U.S. proposal for a 30-day ceasefire with Russia. Next move, Moscow.
For Tuesday, March 11th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Ahead this hour, the latest from our team in Ukraine on the potential breakthrough to end the war there.
Also, the scramble on Capitol Hill to avoid a government shutdown at midnight Friday.
We'll have the votes. We're going to pass the CR. We can do it on our own. But what I'm saying is Democrats ought to do the responsible thing and keep the government open.
And how two people found unexpected joy amid the devastation of the early days of COVID shutdowns.
You know, we're best friends.
I've never been anybody's bestie before, but I am now.
A pandemic love story after this summary of the day's news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. The Trump administration is working towards its promise of eliminating the U.S. Department of Education. As NPR's Tanaka Mehta reports, the agency released a statement today saying it will lay off nearly 50% of its workforce.
The announcement says affected staff will be placed on administrative leave beginning March 21st. The statement confirms all divisions within the agency will be hit by cuts, but it also says the Education Department will continue to deliver programs protected by law, including, quote, student loans, Pell Grants, funding for special needs students, and competitive grant making. According to the announcement, 1,950 positions will be cut, including 600 employees who accepted voluntary resignations over the last 2 months. Exactly who will be laid off is still unclear. Janaki Mehta, NPR News.
The White House is requiring science agencies to send them plans for major cuts to their workforces by Thursday. As NPR's Jonathan Lambert explains, Democrats overseeing the agencies are asking for the plans as well.
Democrats on the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology sent letters to five science agencies today asking for their reduction in force plans as soon as they're sent to the White House. Quote, we are extremely concerned that the so-called Department of Government Efficiency will seek to slash and burn core functions, unquote, of agencies, including the National Science Foundation and NASA. They want to evaluate how the proposed cuts could impair agencies' congressionally mandated missions. Mass firings of probationary employees have already disrupted core government work, including around nuclear safety and monitoring bird flu. The letters call on agency leaders to ensure future firings don't compromise agency work or endanger public safety. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
House Republicans have voted to avert a partial government shutdown, lawmakers passing a measure to keep the government funded through September. The resolution now goes to the Senate. Whirling from the on-again, off-again, tit-for-tat tariffs, the stock market sank for a second straight day. NPR's Maria Aspen reports the Dow closed down while the tech-heavy NASDAQ is starting to bounce back.
President Trump has long courted Wall Street's approval. During his first term, he regularly boasted about the stock market's performance, and he ran for the second presidency by promising investors many business-friendly policies. But now, Trump appears to be prioritizing the leverage power of tariffs above all else, including the stock market and the pain that a trade war would cause the U.S. economy. He spooked investors over the weekend by declining to rule out a recession this year. The White House shrugged off the stock market's reaction, saying that the country is in, quote, a period of economic transition. Maria Aspen, NPR News, New York.
The Dow fell 478 points. This is NPR. Polls have opened in Greenland for early elections, even as President Donald Trump continues to say he would welcome the Arctic island to come under U.S. control. Currently a self-governing region of Denmark, Greenland is home to about 56,000 indigenous Inuit people. It occupies a strategic North American location and also contains some rare earth minerals that are increasingly driving the global economy. America's craft brewers have a lot at stake in President Trump's trade war. Colorado Public Radio's Sarah Mulholland reports just about everything brewers need to make beer is about to get more pricey if the tariffs go through.
Deal kegs, barley from Canada, and the looming tariffs on aluminum are especially troubling. Dave Thibodeau is president of Ska Brewery in Durango, Colorado. He says two-thirds of his company's beer is sold in aluminum cans.
Cans are a lot cheaper than bottles. So it's kind of crazy. I feel like as far as looking at alternatives, like something other than an aluminum can, I don't know that we can get anything less expensive.
In his latest move, President Trump doubled down on steel and aluminum tariffs. The likely upshot for beer drinkers is more expensive brew. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Mulholland in Denver.
Guatemala's volcano of fire is erupting, and authorities now say they've removed nearly 300 families while warning another 30,000 people in the area could be at risk. The eruption started overnight. There are no immediate reports of any casualties. The 12,300-foot-high volcano is one of the most active in Central America. A 2018 eruption killed 194 people and left more than 200 others missing. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Ukraine has accepted a U.S. proposal for a 30-day ceasefire. Now, this would go into effect immediately if Russia agrees. Here's U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio.
Today we made an offer that the Ukrainians have accepted, which is to enter into a ceasefire and into immediate negotiations to end this conflict in a way that's enduring and sustainable. And accounts for their interests, their security, their ability to prosper as a nation.
Rubio was in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia today, where American and Ukrainian delegations hammered out the temporary ceasefire. In return, the U.S. has lifted a freeze on military aid and intelligence sharing with Ukraine. This breakthrough follows perhaps the worst 2 weeks in Ukraine's relationship with the U.S., its most powerful ally. Joining us to talk through all this is NPR's Joanna Kakissis in Kyiv. Hi, Joanna.
Hey, Mary Louise.
Tell me more about this agreement. How would it work? What would it mean?
Well, Mary Louise, it is a tangible step to ending this all-out war that Russia started more than 3 years ago. Ukraine had proposed halting long-range missile strikes and sea strikes as a show of goodwill and on the condition that Russia reciprocate. The proposal that the Ukrainians agreed to today covers not only the sky and the Black Sea, but the entire front line. Here's Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky speaking tonight in a video address.
Ми готові зробити такий крок.
Zelensky is saying, we are ready to take this step. If the Russians agree, the ceasefire will work at that moment.
At that moment. Okay, to this other development I mentioned, the U.S. now saying it will restore the supply of military aid, also of intelligence to Ukraine. Does that signal that relations are back on track or close to getting back on track between Kyiv and Washington?
Well, Mary Louise, a reporter asked Rubio this in Jeddah, and this was his response.
This is not Mean Girls. This is not some episode of some television show. This is very serious. People are going to, today, people will die in this war. They died yesterday, and sadly, unless there's a ceasefire tonight, they'll die tomorrow.
As for Zelensky, he said in his video address that Ukraine has always wanted peace from the very first second Russia invaded the country. And he added that the U.S. now understands Ukraine's arguments for peace. Zelensky thanked President Trump, Congress, the American people for their support, something he often does. This must be a relief for him after 2 weeks of absolute tension with the Trump administration. I'm sure you recall that a couple of weeks ago, Zelensky had a disastrous visit with Trump in the Oval Office that ended with Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance berating Zelensky on camera. And after that, the White House cut off military aid and intelligence sharing.
Yeah. So to the wild card now, whether Russia gets on board, because you have to have Russia on board for this 30-day ceasefire to work. How likely is that, Joanna?
Well, the Kremlin hasn't said anything yet, and Russia did not have representatives at the talks in Jeddah. Both Rubio and Zelensky have said that the ball is now in Russia's court. Russia may not be in a negotiating mood. It blamed Ukraine today for a massive drone strike on Moscow and other parts of Russia. There are reports that Trump envoy Steve Witkoff might go to Russia soon to meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin, maybe to talk about next steps.
Hmm. Well, say Russia does agree. Say a ceasefire does kick in. That would bring expectations, hope for a lasting peace deal. But how far apart are the two sides?
Well, Russia has stopped, has not stopped demanding lots of concessions from Ukraine, like giving up its occupied territory, even territory that's not held by the Russians, giving up on joining NATO, downsizing the military. Ukraine doesn't want any of this right now, and it does not trust Russia to honor the terms of a ceasefire. So a lot of work still has to be done to bring a durable peace deal.
Reporting tonight from our Joanna Kakissis in Kyiv. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Now to Syria, where the promise of the early days of the new government's takeover seems to be evaporating. The killing of hundreds from the Alawite religious minority is posing serious obstacles to unifying the country after nearly 14 years of civil war. The new government has sealed off the area where the clashes took place, but as NPR's Jaina Raff reports, tensions had been brewing for weeks already, and a warning. This report contains graphic descriptions of violence.
In the village of Miryamin, a few miles from the major city of Homs in western Syria, we enter the home of Wissam Bilal and walk into a chorus of grief. It's late January, just 5 days since Bilal, who is 40, was dragged out of the house by masked gunmen and shot dead. The home still looks like a crime scene. His sister takes me by the hand into ransacked bedrooms, past a sofa with the cushions shot out, a TV with a bullet hole. They shot in front of a four-year-old child, says Bilal's older sister, Ibtisam Bilal. She says the boy is so traumatized, he imitates the sound of gunfire. His widow, Mais Muhammad, says the gunmen took all their money and their gold jewelry, anything of value, and even things like their photo albums that weren't. Ibtisam says the gunmen called them pigs and drove away in her brother's car. Muhammad is still in shock. Where is public security, she asks. Ibtisam says they want international protection. Bilal was a car dealer who had been a low-level security officer, a job he took because they needed the money, his sister says. The residents of Miryamin are mostly Alawite, an offshoot of Shia Islam, and the same sect as toppled President Bashar al-Assad. They and other minorities seen as supporting the former regime have been targeted by Sunni Arab fighters. This is not the liberation of Syria, Ibtisam says, referring to the name of the group now in power in Damascus. This is the destruction of Syria. Nine-year-old Haider says he wants his dad. He describes seeing gunmen throwing his father to the ground and covering his head before taking him away. Muhammad is now a 30-year-old widow with three young children. The family blames the new government for not protecting them. To whom do we complain, she asks. Who will return a father to his child? The attacks are an extremely sensitive issue for a government trying to persuade citizens they will be safe in this new Syria. A top political official in the Homs governor's office acknowledges the killings, but says the gunmen who entered Miryamin were not connected with government forces. These are criminals, says Obaid al-Arno. He blames regime remnants trying to sabotage the new government. He says gunmen who rampaged through the village are now in jail. But Ibtisam Bilal told NPR a month later that they had still heard nothing from authorities. At a shop on the main street, we talked to more victims of the day-long attack on the village. A young man, his broken hands wrapped in blue bandages, says masked gunmen beat him with sticks after dragging him out by the hair. His elderly mother says they stopped only when she kissed the leader's boots. He gave her his name, a common nom de guerre of a Chechen fighter. None of these victims want their names used because they fear for their lives. One young man says the gunman told them to bark like dogs and recorded it with their phones. Another tells us his father was taken to prison and hasn't been seen since. His father says his son is still missing. We later find out his family found his body in the morgue. The governor's office in Humps did not respond to requests for comment. Even the elderly were beaten. Yusuf, 68, says the men made him kneel and pointed a gun at his chest before robbing him. We want a country where there's coexistence, Yusuf says, of multi-ethnic, multi-sectarian Syria. He says they have no other choice. Jane Araf, NPR News, Meryemin, Syria.
This week marks 5 years since the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 a global pandemic. There was so much loss and devastation, but also, occasionally, moments of hope. We are sharing some of those moments this week, starting with Sharla Riddle, a 63-year-old from Mineola, Texas, and a chance encounter with a man named Patrick Bonney.
The grocery store was overwhelmed. They did not have enough workers because it was a lifeline. It was the only store in town. And so I was single and retired and decided that I would apply for a job at the store to help out. And one day a customer came. It was a slow time. And so I was reading like a manual or something sort of boring. And I looked up and the customer, he said, what are you reading?
I think it was after work. I went by to get some gas, and she was working at the kiosk. And she came out, and we talked a little bit. And I had told her I just got through reading, I think it was Treasure Island.
And I said, that's great. And I thought to myself, this guy, he's really pretty great.
Then I started coming back there for my gas.
I would work in the fuel center every day with my little mask on, and he would wear his mask and he would come into the fuel center and he would talk about whatever book he was reading.
And then we just started getting to know each other.
We started calling and talking, and we've been together ever since.
Well, we like fishing and I just enjoy our company.
Our home is full of books.
And she's a really terrific person. Wasn't looking for anybody. I was kind of figuring I'd just kind of wind down the rest of my life pretty much being by myself.
But we just, you know, we're best friends.
I've never been anybody's bestie before, but I am now.
Oh, so lovely. Sharla Riddle and Patrick Bonney talking there, and they say they plan to wed next month.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. In the Rohingya refugee camps of Bangladesh, armed militant groups have been terrorizing and killing members of the community for years. Rights groups say their targets include anyone who refuses to join them. Reporter Shamim Chowdhury tracked down some of their victims and reports from inside the camps in southern Bangladesh.
In Bangladesh's Rohingya refugee camps, there lurks a sense of fear. Armed militant groups have killed, kidnapped, and tortured the people here for years. Among the most notorious are the Arakan Rohingya Salvation Army, or ARSA, and the Rohingya Solidarity Organization, or RSO. The groups, made up of ethnic Rohingya men, claim to fight for the rights of their people. But most in the community reject their violent methods. We track down several of their victims. None would reveal their names for fear of retaliation. One man limps towards us while his wife prepares dinner in his home. He says he was approached by men he recognized as members of ARSA in 2018. They wanted to recruit him. When he refused, he says they tortured him.
They blindfolded me and beat me so hard that I passed out. When I regained consciousness, they were still beating me, and my ears were bleeding.
His injuries were so severe that 6 years on, he is partially deaf and can't stand up straight. ARSA and RSO started out as armed groups in Myanmar's Rakhine state, near the Bangladesh border. They targeted the military and claimed to protect Rohingya rights, whose citizenship was stripped in 1982. Myanmar labels both groups as terrorist organizations, which they reject. After the 2017 Rohingya exodus to Bangladesh, the groups aimed to continue operations in Myanmar. But their violent tactics gained little support from the Rohingya. As a result, they resorted to coercion and even killing those who opposed them, according to an upcoming report by rights group 45 Rights. It found that killings by the groups in the camps rose from 22 in 2021 to 90 in 2023. The findings were confirmed by the Bangladeshi authorities. Director John Quinley says there's been a lack of political will to confront these groups.
We asked the family, relatives, others, you know, if they knew of any ongoing investigations, and they said, you know, the police didn't talk to us. These groups were able to operate with impunity because they knew even if they were detained, they would get released after a number of months.
Other organizations, including the International Crisis Group and Amnesty International, have also documented both the group's violence against civilians. In October, Bangladesh's interim government, led by Nobel laureate Mohamed Yunus, brokered talks between the groups. The violence has stopped for now, but residents of this camp fear the group's activities could resume at any time. One man says he still has nightmares when he thinks of ARSA. He says he was forced to fight with them in Myanmar for 3 months in 2017. They wanted him to go back to Rakhine, but when he refused, they tortured him. He shows me his scars, deep gashes across his forehead, legs, and torso.
They beat me every night. They hanged me from the ceiling. They beat me with a wire cable. They did this for 2 months. I couldn't take it anymore, so I told them I'd go to Myanmar.
He now believes he'll have no choice but to go to Myanmar at the end of this month, after the end of the Muslim month of Ramadan. Yunus's press secretary Shafiqul Alam says the interim government has stepped up security in the camps.
We have launched investigation into every case of deadly clashes, violence, or even abductions.
For the Rohingya, the hope now is that this long-awaited break from violence will endure. For NPR News, I'm Shamim Chowdhury in the Rohingya refugee camps, southern Bangladesh.
Twenty-six teams of sled dogs are currently racing the longest Iditarod trail in history. This year's route grew by more than 100 miles at the last minute because there was not enough snow to cover the traditional route, forcing the race to move north. Now, it's only the fourth time in history that that has happened, and a climate expert says it is more likely to keep happening with climate change. From Alaska Public Media, Ava White has the story.
The Iditarod Trail sled dog race started last Monday with hundreds of barking sled dogs and mushers high-fiving fans as they hit the trail.
4, 3, 2, 1, go. All right, let's hear some noise for Jason.
But it started in Fairbanks, over 200 miles north of the usual starting point near Anchorage. The race's CEO, Rob Urbach, says swapping the start location was 10 months of work in 10 days. We spoke to him by phone from the race headquarters in Wasilla.
Between planes, trains, automobiles, we had to move our whole ecosystem.
Almost all of the checkpoints Iditarod mushers pass through are rural villages only accessible by plane, boat, or, well, sled dogs. That means organizers had to move some stockpiles of food, dog bedding, and other supplies to totally new places.
There's a lot of changes at Cascade. You had to go back and resupply and get those supplies by flying.
Sections along the trail have been warm. The sled dogs optimally run in freezing temperatures, but one musher clocked 50 degrees earlier on the trail. Race officials also said the Fairbanks start was the warmest ever. It's not just the race itself that's affected by sparse snow coverage and warmer weather across the state, says rookie musher Justin Olms. He lives near Fairbanks and says less snow at the start of the season meant less training miles for his team. It's also changed the traits he and other mushers prioritize when breeding sled dogs.
You know, traditionally, when people think of sled dogs, they think of thick-coated, larger, stockier breeds, and those are just not conducive anymore to the conditions that we have. We need these leaner, shorter-coated dogs to be able to handle the heat.
Olm says it also affects their ability to hunt salmon to feed their dogs.
Because those have collapsed due to climate-related changes in the ocean, it all paints a more challenging picture for mushing.
Alaska is warming 2 to 3 times the global average due to human-caused greenhouse gas pollution. That warming means less snow for winter sports like the Iditarod, says University of Alaska Fairbanks climate specialist Rick Toman. He says warmer temperatures in autumn are causing precipitation to fall more as rain than snow.
We don't have that autumn buffer the way we used to.
That buffer was a buildup of snow that could withstand warm spells and dry spells later in the season. In the Iditarod's 50-plus year history, the race has only moved north 4 times, but 3 of them were in the past decade.
Maybe it'll be a while till the next one, but these are going to be more common than they used to be.
Mushers are nearing the last stretch of the race. Based on previous results and extra mileage, a winner is expected Thursday. For NPR News, I'm Ava White in Unalakleet.
And this story was reported with help from Shelby Herbert in Galena.
This is NPR News.
Astronauts Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams have been on the International Space Station since last June. Now they're expected to return home on a spacecraft made by Elon Musk's SpaceX.
We came up prepared to stay long, even though we planned to stay short.
The next step in their extended journey tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. TikTok star Dylan Mulvaney went viral documenting her transition for millions of viewers.
Now she is focused on a new chapter, one full of joy.
1,000 bad things can go down, but at the end of the day, 1,001 great things are possible. And that's, I'm just going to go chase 1,002.
Now News.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. While U.S. and Ukrainian delegations are meeting in Saudi Arabia, European and other NATO military officials are gathered in Paris, focusing on the creation of an international force to secure a ceasefire between Ukraine and Russia. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports.
The Trump administration's about-face on Ukraine shook European leaders. Ukrainian Taras Yatsenko, the founder of an independent media house, says it's about time.
Europe is really awakening. Kind of too late a bit, but really awakening.
But he says Europe must go faster and be tougher.
We need much more production of weapons to be able to defend Ukraine and Europe.
France and Britain say their armies could provide the backbone of a security force in Ukraine. The Europeans are afraid a Putin-friendly Trump administration may try to push Ukraine into a disadvantageous ceasefire that's more like a capitulation. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Kyiv.
The National Transportation Safety Board is calling for a ban on many helicopter flights near Washington's Reagan National Airport in the wake of January's deadly collision between a military chopper and an American Airlines jet. NPR's David Shaper reports.
As part of its investigation into the mid-air collision of an Army Black Hawk helicopter and an American Airlines regional jet that killed all 67 people on board both aircraft, the NTSB found that the distances between helicopters on that route along the Potomac River and commercial jetliners coming in for landings at Reagan National Airport to be insufficient.
And pose an intolerable risk to aviation safety by increasing the chances of a mid-air collision at DCA.
NTSB Chair Jennifer Homedy is calling for temporary helicopter flight restrictions around Reagan National Airport to become permanent. For NPR News, I'm David Shaper.
And you're listening to NPR News. 5 years ago today, the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 a global pandemic. Now, medical experts are pausing to assess how prepared the world is for a future pandemic. NPR's Gabriella Emanuel has more.
One thing that's improved is scientists' ability to get quick and accurate data about what diseases are circulating. Eric Carlson heads the National Influenza Center of Cambodia. He's developed a lab in a suitcase that can test for a whole slew of viruses at once and then sequence the genome, all while in the field.
We are now ahead of the game, right? So we're now detecting things almost in real time. And it's very specific and very accurate and very sensitive.
But other experts warn that public trust in that disease data has dropped substantially. And a troubled international agreement on information and resource sharing still has a long way to go. Gabriella Emanuel, NPR News.
The Premier of Ontario, Canada, has rescinded a 25% surcharge or tariff on electricity it ships to three U.S. states. But it's unclear if President Trump's additional 25% tariff on Canadian steel and aluminum will be rescinded tomorrow. The threats have roiled both businesses and investors with another big day of losses on Wall Street. I'm Duane Brown. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station And from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From EasyCater, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from a nationwide network of restaurants, create lunch programs for their employees, and manage food spend at easycater.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The House has approved legislation to fund federal agencies through September. House Republicans had crafted the bill without Democratic input, and the bill did pass largely along party lines. It heads to the Senate next, where Republicans will need some support from Democrats to avoid a shutdown at midnight on Friday. NPR congressional correspondent Deirdre Walsh has been tracking the vote from the Capitol. She joins us now. Hey there.
Hey there.
Okay, tell us a little bit about what's in this bill and why Congress is here once again bumping into yet another deadline for a possible shutdown.
Right. This is Congress kicking the can again because it failed to pass the annual dozen spending bills that fund federal agencies. Congress's basic duty is to approve legislation setting spending levels for programs across the government. But the leaders of the spending panels in the House and Senate were working to try to get a deal on those bills after they passed the last stopgap funding bill, but they weren't able to get that done. So this is a six-month funding bill to keep agencies operating at essentially the current spending levels.
A six-month funding bill, you said. And how are Republicans explaining that? Why do they want another temporary spending bill?
Well, House Republican leaders say that extending the current funding levels gives them more time to incorporate the cuts that Elon Musk and his government efficiency team are making and put them into next year's spending bill. President Trump endorsed the bill, and he argued that a government shutdown could derail his agenda. He worked the phones today, and Republicans who were undecided basically fell in line. There was one Republican, Kentucky Congressman Tom Massey, who was the only Republican to vote no. Mm-hmm. Conservatives who have vowed they would never vote for stopgap bills all voted yes on this one. House Speaker Mike Johnson argued it's a different moment because they're trying to keep critical government functions going and have time to reshape federal agencies.
It solves the problem because it freezes federal spending. It takes care of these immediate priorities that have been articulated here, and it allows us to move forward with changing the size and scope of the federal government.
Okay, so that is the Republican speaker, Speaker Johnson. But what about Democrats in the House? Because in past, Republicans have relied on Democrats to help pass funding bills, help avoid shutdowns. Why are Democrats firmly against this temporary funding bill?
Well, House Democratic leaders argued this was not just a clean funding extension, that it included some cuts to health care and veterans programs. And they were mostly able to hold the House Democratic caucus together. Only one Democrat, Maine Congressman Jared Golden, voted with Republicans to pass the bill tonight. Democrats also argued this funding bill essentially gives a blank check to Elon Musk. They say he will just ignore what Congress approves and impose cuts more unilaterally. And, you know, they also argued that if they helped Republicans pass this funding bill, it would pave the way to enact the rest of Trump's agenda, renewing tax cuts that expire at the end of the year and boosting money for immigration enforcement. And they oppose that effort.
Okay, so to sum up and state the obvious, this has now passed the House, but in the Senate, we will see. Republicans, of course, have control there, too, but there they do need help from Democrats to get the 60 votes they're going to need to avoid a filibuster. Are they going to get those 60 votes?
It could be tight. You know, Democrats are going to face a lot of pressure as the deadline to avoid a shutdown approaches on Friday. Speaker Johnson's already trying to blame the Senate Democrats if a bill fails. Earlier, Georgia Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock called this Republican stopgap bill a terrible bill.
The outcomes of this one way or the other is theirs. This is their bill. There's a government shutdown. They're in control of the House. The Senate and the White House is their shutdown.
Warnock talking there about Republicans. He wouldn't say how he would vote. He was part of an intense two-hour meeting earlier today. The top Senate Democrat, Chuck Schumer, has sidestepped questions about what Senate Democrats are going to do. Republicans are going to need help from roughly eight Democrats because they have a 53-seat majority in the Senate and need to get 60 votes to get around a filibuster. There is one Senate Republican, Rand Paul of Kentucky, who says he will vote no.
And here's Deirdre Walsh on Capitol Hill. Thanks, Deirdre.
Thank you.
Every week, a famous guest draws a card from the wild card deck and answers a big question about their life. This week, author Zadie Smith reflects on the 25th anniversary of her debut novel, White Teeth, and she says the book has amassed an audience that she's proud of.
The thing I love about it is that teenagers love it. Teenagers pick it up and read it. And to me, that's exactly where it should be. That is a book for young people. And all the books for young people that exist, from Catcher to, I don't know, something like Sula, Toni Morris, I love those books.
She talked to Wildcard host Rachel Martin about life since then and how her relationship with time has shifted over the years.
What emotion do you understand better than all the others?
Gosh. Regret. I think that's the one I know very well. Yeah.
May I ask
one? I think people's lives are so profoundly shot through with regret. And they don't talk about it very often, particularly in America. It's like a failure, right?
It's like a four-letter word. And when people bring up the ideal of regret, you don't admit it because it's made you who you are, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
I'm always hearing people on television saying, no regrets. Sorry, not sorry. I'm
wow,
dude.
I don't believe
dude,
that for one second.
I am so sorry. I am so filled with regret. It must be amazing never to feel sorry.
Right.
So, yeah, regret is something that I really feel, if only for the simple and selfish fact that you get one life, you know, and I'm so hungry for life that I could live it like 10 times. And once it's, you know, it's a tough deal.
May I ask if you're willing to share a thing that you wish you had done differently or that had gone differently?
I just wish I was less selfish. Writing is a very selfish thing to have done with your time, and it takes up all the time. And I wish I had done a bit less of it, or thought about what else I could have done in that time. Because it's all I did. I just wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote, and wrote, which is great. But there's a lot of other things in life that you can do apart from that.
Yeah. It's the bummer about time.
Yeah.
That it's kind of bound.
Yeah. But it's cool. All... Like once I realized it, like I've taken steps, you know, I do other things now. I'm out in my community. I'm volunteering. I'm like engaged. And it feels so much better than sitting at a desk. Just writing every day.
Well, it's also lonely, I imagine. Like just what that work is.
It is a little bit lonely. Like during COVID, when everybody was freaking out, I took it kind of personally because it's like, wait, so the thing you hate is my life?
Is my life.
you hate my life, but I've been living my life for 30 years. And to you, it's the worst thing imaginable. I'm like, oh.
To be sequestered at home.
Because I literally
with
do
your
that
thoughts.
Every day. So I did take it a little bit personally, but it was a wake-up call. I was like, this is not normal. People don't enjoy this. This thing that you do every day. You should try doing something else.
You can hear more of that conversation with Zadie Smith on the Wildcard Podcast.
Support for Wildcard with Rachel Martin comes from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business. With an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. You've heard of tailgating, you know, showing up to the stadium a few hours early for pregame festivities in the parking lot. Well, in Norway, cross-country skiing has what you might call trailgating. Reporter Nat Herz was at the Nordic World Ski Championships in Norway last weekend and found some truly committed fans.
John Hammerness and his wife and kids wanted to be sure to get a good spot to watch the championships in the forest near the central Norwegian city of Trondheim. So they got here early.
We set up the tent 3 weeks ago.
3 weeks ago?
To reserve the place.
I find them frying bacon over hot coals, sitting on reindeer and sheepskins next to the 30 bags of firewood that Hammerness hauled in from a parking lot.
We have also a fireplace inside the tent. It's nice and cozy. You can sit in a t-shirt.
Organizers say as many as 20,000 fans are in the woods here to watch their national heroes glide past and try to conquer the rival Swedes. Ragnar Hoas, another fan, explains.
You know, all the Norwegians are born with the skis, so the traditional Norwegian heritage is to go skiing. We like to see our athletes. We are very happy when they are winning. But of course, we allow the Swedish neighbors to win sometimes.
Hoas was one of another 30,000 people who watched in the enormous stadium. Think American football, but replace the gridiron with a ski trail that winds out and up into the forest. Norway's men's team has won a slew of gold medals, as have the Swedish women, but American Jesse Diggins made the podium as well. The top-ranked female skier in the world coming into this competition, Diggins struggled with her equipment, but she did win a silver medal.
I had to keep believing in myself and believing in my body and taking care of my body and knowing that it will come. We will nail it. All the skis, the wax, the glide, my body, it will all come together on the right day. And yeah. I had to keep that faith. But that does not come easily. It's work. And I think it's okay to acknowledge that.
Diggins finished second in the team sprint with Julia Kern. She's one of a few top U.S. prospects who are coming into their own just in time for next year's Olympics. Kern is also involved in a big off-trail story. These races score big TV ratings in Europe, and climate campaigners were threatening to disrupt them over oil company sponsorship. But Kern and another American, Alaskan Gus Schumacher, led international athletes in negotiations that prompted the group to stand down. Here's Schumacher.
It's kind of easy to be like in your house where you don't feel a lot of the changes, but you know, like we're at Fairbanks latitude in Norway, and it's 50 degrees, and it's barely March, you know, and like Anchorage is out of snow, which sucks. And those are like small problems in the full like Earth climate issue, but yeah, it's like where we see it.
The agreement says the athletes will work with the campaigners to phase out fossil fuel sponsorship of major international ski events, and to prioritize advertising deals with companies that commit to climate leadership and the long-term future of winter sport. Kern says that rainy, sloppy conditions in Trondheim underscored the importance of the climate work, but the weather barely dampened the enthusiasm of the Norwegian crowd. For NPR News, I'm Nat Herz in Trondheim.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. When Dylan Mulvaney was 4 years old, she told her mother that she thought God might have made a mistake, that God had put a girl in a boy's body. Dylan's mother responded that God doesn't make mistakes. It would be years before Dylan officially embraced her identity as a transgender woman when she was 25, after coming out as gay at 14 and non-binary at 24, which is why she didn't feel like going the route of the dramatic coming out video.
I had done those before. This was my third time coming out, and I felt like I needed to find the funny.
So Dylan took to TikTok to post her lighthearted take on the way she was figuring out what it meant to live as a girl.
Day one of being a girl, and I have already cried three times. I wrote a scathing email that I did not send. I ordered dresses online that I couldn't afford. And then when someone asked me how I was, I said, I'm fine, when I wasn't fine. So.
I really didn't expect it to turn into a series until there was, you know, many supporters, but many hateful comments. And I wanted to show those people that I had many layers to me and that there were other more, you know, nuanced versions for them to see. And then it became sort of this way to track not only my journey, but, you know, to share a little bit of trans joy, which I think now the book is an extension of that joy.
That new book is Paper Doll, Notes from a Late Bloomer. It's a memoir of Mulvaney's explosive fame, documenting her transition and all the highs and lows that came with it. And a warning, this interview mentions suicide.
I think that I didn't know how to get to where, like, a Laverne Cox, you know, was. These icons, Dominique Jackson, Our Lady J, who's now a dear mentor and friend. I wasn't sure how to get to where these icons were in their transitions. And so I really wanted to take people along that journey. And, you know, transness right now, it's being seen as this very villainous thing. It almost feels like Godzilla taking over the world. And yet we're less than 1% of the population. And most of the community is really struggling to get the care that they deserve and that they need. And so my documentation of it and my experience of, you know, obtaining that care so easily and having these opportunities isn't quite as reflective as the general community is. But I really hope that one day it will be, that you know, every trans person feels like they have the opportunity to thrive.
There's an incident that happened back in 2023 that you call Beergate, and I want to get into all of that. It's been covered a lot, but I want to briefly recap for folks. Back in April of 2023, you posted this sponsored video for the company Bud Light.
This month, I celebrated my day 365 of womanhood, and Bud Light sent me possibly the best gift ever, a can with my face on it.
Check out. And that led to this really big backlash. Conservatives boycotted the band. Some people may recall the musician Kid Rock posting this video of himself. He was online shooting Bud Light cases. You were also the subject of some ugly vitriol online, some violent threats. You've talked about this in the book, and I know that you've spoken about this before, but I just want to know, what is it that you want people to understand about what that time in your life was like for you, how you experienced it?
I talk about it in the book like dark thoughts, and I write them sometimes as little bubbles that look like black clouds, but they were very real, and they were not just an illustration of my life. They were, you know, they showed up as suicidal ideation and dissociation. And I think, you know, so often when you're seen as such a classically happy person, that people don't really account for that. But behind the scenes, I was hurting in a way that I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy.
You wrote about the fact that you wished that you'd stepped away to get mental health treatment in the immediate aftermath of what happened then. I wonder, having gone through that experience and now being at a very different point in your life, what did it teach you about yourself? What did you learn about yourself?
Well, not only what I learned about myself, I think what I learned about the world is that, especially when it comes to women in the public eye, so often we are not allowed to create boundaries. We're not allowed to ask for what we need because of how we're treated. And I think I learned that in that moment, I needed to take my transition back for my own self, and that this wasn't up to anyone else, whether that's the government or my followers or, you know, branded companies. I needed to make sure that the decisions I was making on behalf of me and my body were my own.
Shifting gears a bit, I know that you grew up in the church and going to Catholic school, and I also did, and I know that for me in my adulthood, faith is a thing that I've struggled to figure out where I land, and that seems to be something that you and I share. And you,
yes,
you talk about in the book about how the religion and the church that you were brought up in doesn't really fit anymore. What's your relationship with your faith today?
Oh, you know, I see so much beauty, not only in transness, but in so much of the world, even during this really, really dark, dark time. And I think so often people are using religion against queer and trans people in a really ugly way. But I also see and honor why queer and trans folks are deeply triggered by some of these things. So, you know, I kind of tried to hide the peas in the mashed potatoes of the book of letting people know that I do, you know, believe in something bigger than me, and that my transness is not something to be ashamed of, and that there were no mistakes made when I was created, and that this is just part of my story, and even though it looks a little different than most women's.
You write to the reader in the opening of this book that I need you to believe that sweet earnestness still exists. And Dylan, that is just something that, from everything I've seen and everything I've heard, that you seem to embody. How is it that you managed to hold on to that?
Whenever I've tried the pessimistic thing, it just doesn't feel as good. And I've arrived at this place of 1,000 bad things can go down, and they can try to make me into a pessimist. But at the end of the day, 1,001 great things are possible and have already happened. And that's, I'm just going to go chase 1,002, because I don't think I'm interested in living this life for anything but constant discovery and seeing what a new day can bring. And that might sound so silly, but I would like to believe that we can live that way.
Dylan, what do you hope comes next for you? What are you looking for in your next chapter?
Oh, gosh, I would love to feel safe, you know, in my country. I would love to watch other trans people thriving and given the opportunities that I have and not met with such ridicule. My next writing project I've given myself is a rom-com. I'd love to write something where a trans person is finding joy and isn't just a victim on Law and Order. I think we need to find us everywhere in all forms of media, and not just the rage bait.
We've been speaking with Dylan Mulvaney. Her memoir, Paper Doll, Notes from a Late Bloomer, is out now. Dylan, thank you so much.
Thank you. This was so lovely.
If you or someone you love is experiencing a crisis, call or text 988 for the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. No
one is alone. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at viking.com. From the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Subaru, the 2025 Subaru Outback features standard symmetrical all-wheel drive, including safety features like EyeSight Driver Assist technology. Learn more at Subaru.com.
Corino, where you been so long? Corino, baby, where you been so long? Ain't had no loving mama since you've been gone. Corino, where you stayed last night? Corino, where you stayed last night? Come in this morning, baby, sun was shining bright.